mortgage capital markets decisions carry real financial consequences. That's why Optimal Blue commissioned an independent ROI study with MarketWise advisors, analyzing results across hundreds of lenders. The study highlights consistent gains in efficiency, accuracy, and financial performance, including an average $1,006 net benefit per loan. To be notified when the full 2026 Optimal Blue ROI study is released in May, sign up at optimalblue.com/2026-study.
You have to trust the technology that's working for you. The loan officer or, you know, the relationship manager want to be able to trust it. But you also, as an owner, you have to lower your cost and you have to produce quality and you have to have a loan that you can deliver into the secondary market. I mean, that is all mission critical.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Vice President of Hedging and Trading Client Services at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode. Welcome, everybody. It is November 10th. Good afternoon. A lot to talk about today. Really good show for you as usual. We'll start out with a market update. We'll talk with Alex and James. Got a little bit of data last week that we'll talk about from University of Michigan. We'll talk about some Fed speakers. We'll talk about the partial end to the government shutdown story, which seems to be unfolding here on Monday. And also just discuss a little bit of what we've been seeing on social media over the weekend from Donald Trump, from Bill Pulte, and then some of the reactions to it around a 50-year mortgage, around just more creativity surrounding home affordability. After that, we have the rare honor of interviewing Anita Padilla Fitzgerald. Many of you know her in our industry. She is the CEO of an extremely successful mortgage company called Megastar. She's also the founder of Take 3 Technology, which includes a platform called Loan Maps. Anyway, we'll get into just a ton of good content with Anita about the mortgage industry and about just technology in the mortgage industry. All right, before that, let's talk a little bit about data. OBMMI 6.2 right now, still stubbornly high above that five handle. The 10-year is at 4.11, so it's still continuing to see that spread tighten a little bit between those two numbers, but still not quite hitting that five handle that we'd all like to see. But good volume in the industry right now, you know, pretty steady purchase volume, but seeing a good spike in rate and term and cash outs in the OBMMI data. All right, let's go talk with Alex and James about what's going on in the market. All right, James, Alex, lots to talk about today, which is a welcome development. We don't have a ton of data, but we actually did get a little bit of data we'll talk about with the Michigan consumer sentiment. Maybe we'll start with hopefully some good news from the weekend. The government might be reopening, is what we're hearing. The votes are starting to move their way through, and at least on an interim deal, right, through end of January. Is that what y'all are hearing?
Correct. Yeah. We had 8 Democratic senators kind of flip to get them straight to a 60-40 vote, and they need a 60-40 vote to pass the Senate bill. There really were not major concessions made, it seems that the Democrats have conceded on the Affordable Care Act that they've been holding out for, that wasn't included in the bill that they sent back to the House for approval. There were provisions in there regarding SNAP benefits. So it seems that they've maybe kind of struck a middle ground, but they've definitely not gotten what they've been holding out for.
There is a provision in what they've put forward that a vote in December has to be done on whether or not to extend the ACA. But that's whether or not to do it. So we'll cross that bridge again, you know, 30 days from now.
But right.
Everyone can agree, right? Just in time for travel for the holidays, and everyone who's on SNAP should be getting it. So these are definitely positives. And for us, a little bit more data will be coming out very soon here. So can approve of that.
Yay, data. Right on. Yeah. So furloughed workers are going to get back pay here soon. So hopefully that means, yes, especially folks like the air traffic control workers who have been slowing down a little bit and causing some travel troubles for others. I guess that impact will be minimized here with hopefully with folks getting paid again, as they should be. But the Affordable Care Act, which is essentially Obamacare, right? That's been the most contentious item in this whole shutdown. And they're kind of kicking that can down the road to around Christmas when we'll have a vote on that. So hopefully get something in place before this bill expires, which would be January 30th, they said, right? So we're just sort of an interim path to reopening the government.
Yeah, definitely. I wouldn't say we're out of the woods yet. One, this bill has to go back to the House. The House will make any changes that they deem fit. It has to pass the House again, and then it'll get sent back to the Senate for a final approval. So not out of the woods on this, you know, round of the government shutdown quite yet, although things are looking good from what everyone's saying in the media. And then on top of that, as you say, you know, we could be back here again in December and January facing another shutdown. And then once the holiday travel season's by, you know, they might deem it a little more okay to keep things shut down for longer periods of time. I think it really did seem like, you know, the two sticking points for a lot of Americans were SNAP benefits, which makes a lot of sense for, you know, getting food in your stomach. Then the second major point really did seem to be the fact that, you know, people just can't get places via air travel. So, you know, maybe it could be a little more politically convenient to keep things shut down a little longer in the spring. You know, I don't want to be a pessimist about it, and hopefully they can arrive at a longer term funding deal, but I could see that path opening, you know, mid-January or so.
All right. So more to come on that, hopefully in the next 24 hours. So let's just stay on the government here for a minute. If y'all have been following social media over the weekend, there was more talk about affordability from the president as well as Bill Pulte. And then that's kind of started a domino effect of folks opining on the latest idea, or I guess the latest proposition to come from the White House, which would be a 50-year mortgage. So something we've heard before. You know, we've had 40-year mortgages before. We've had things like interest only. We've had creative vehicles to try to lower the monthly payment for borrowers. But this time around, 50-year mortgage was proposed and kind of thrown out there as a way to make housing more affordable, especially for first-time homebuyers. It did not land well, I'll say, at least in the circles that I've been following, which is a pretty broad spectrum, especially, you know, on LinkedIn, which is mostly people from our industry. Didn't have great things to say about it. Obviously, a 50-year mortgage doesn't exactly, you're going to pay a lot more over time is what that amounts to. Your monthly payment might drop by a couple hundred bucks because you're spreading out the principal over a longer period of time. But for that reason, you're also paying a lot more interest in the long run, almost, you know, 50% more than you would be otherwise. So anyway, it got shot down pretty well by the masses, and maybe deservedly so. But I think that was, you know, that came on the heels of other discussion about LLPAs, which that saga kind of took a turn last week as well, where the meetings with Barry Habib and others, I don't know if they fizzled out or they kind of ended with no real proposal that I could see, other than they were discussing some ways to lower LLPAs on things like second homes and investment properties that had been jacked up during the pandemic. But that obviously doesn't help, you know, the first time home buyer or the folks who want to refinance their primary residence. I don't know. Did you guys read much more on some of this rhetoric coming out of the kind of the FHFA circle?
I had a couple of the numbers written down. I thought that this was a good way to think about it. So California, the average home price is $800,000, which that is something to sit with on its own. But $800,000, California, 6%. For a 30-year mortgage, you're paying like $4,800 a month. With a 50-year mortgage, you'd be paying $4,220. So it's like a $600 difference. No one's going to say $600 is nothing. That's worth it. But the interest payment that you're going to pay over time effectively doubles. It adds $1.7 million in interest to the payment that you're going to do, which that's a staggering number. Definitely hard to swallow. I think that's, you know, when people sat down, just did the math and kind of saw these, is $600 a month really going to cut it for people when you're going to spend an extra 20 years paying $2 million?
Right. The math just doesn't make it that attractive when you put the pencil to it, which kind of makes sense. Like there's not a really good way to cheat this affordability issues. I think what we're finding from all of these different ideas. So yeah, $600 for a handful of years. I suppose that the idea would be with the hopes that rates dip at some point in the next decade and you can get out of that 50-year mortgage and into a a shorter term at a lower rate. But assuming you can't, assuming rates keep rising with deficits and taxes, you know, presumably given the, you know, average first time home buyers in their late 30s, you're literally going to be probably dead by the time, you know, you pay off a 50-year mortgage if you actually take it to its term.
Absolutely. No, I think what James said is spot on, and you can play with the numbers, whatever state you're in, whatever your locale's average home price is, it does come out to about doubling the cost of your loan. I think maybe like one caveat you could say is it's a bit of a, you know, taking out a 50-year, you know, 5% loan, or, you know, maybe by next year, you know, some a little bit lower, you could call it an inflation hedge, but I think that's a tough sell when people are seeing, you know, $600 and okay, like I need my property to double in value for me to break even 50 years down the line, you know, again, assuming I'm still alive and making payments on that 50-year loan. So maybe if your outlook is that rates have a risk to the high side and maybe inflation is in the game, you can make an argument for it, but I'm the same boat as you guys. I think it's going to be a tough sell to a lot of people.
Paying so much more interest for so much longer, it takes much more time for you to have stake in the house, right? For you to be paying principal and actually taking ownership of it. So like if things start going wrong, hey, I've been paying for 20 years and I still don't even own 10% of the house, like gone.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I applaud the administration for trying to make some moves here, right? And as we've talked about on this podcast over and over again, there's not a simple answer. The LLPAs and G fees thing was an idea, but it would certainly, almost certainly, eat into the profitability of Fannie and Freddie if they were to make major moves there. So that there are some reasons why that's not very palatable. And then you have the ideas of maybe getting the GSEs more active in the open market where they're buying, you know, MBS for their portfolio, sort of like the Fed did during COVID and at other times during quantitative easing. What does that look like? Just to shorten that spread between like treasuries and mortgages, you could get a quarter point, 3/8 of a point there, which that would be a few $100 a month too, right? Without stretching the term out to 50. But anyway, nothing really concrete has come out of any of these discussions, unfortunately. But I like the fact that they're continuing to look for a better answer than what we see today, which is, you know, record low affordability. Speaking of record low, if we want to switch gears a little bit, we did get a little bit of data this week because the University of Michigan does put out some of their own surveys that don't rely on the government to actually come out. So Alex, you and I were talking about this with James before we started recording. What did we get last week and why is it terrible?
Yeah, no, great pivot. But yeah, it's the UMich Consumer Sentiment Index came out in not too hot of shape. You know, expectations were for it to slightly rise, which I don't quite see how they were expecting to see it quite rise in the past month with really no end to the government shutdown in sight. But the real number that came out was a 6.2% drop from the previous release. So it's near historic lows, and it really just kind of, you know, conglomerates all the trends that we talk about on the podcast here. In the housing market, you know, you have record low affordability. In the labor market, you have, you know, slow to fire, you know, and just the general outlook on, you know, for like the lower, you know, 90% of Americans is not super high right now. If you're, you know, not in an asset owning class, your outlook is not super great. You just seen prices rise over the past 5 years or so with declining improvements to your wages. So, you know, I think that just, like I said, just kind of captures the general gist of the U.S. economy for that bottom half.
Yeah, it's that K-shaped economy we keep reading about, right? If you own assets, you own a home, maybe a second home, you own equities, maybe you own a business, generally things are looking pretty well. Prices are going up at pretty much 4 out of 5 days of the week, stock market's up. But if you're on the other side, which is a majority of our country, things are not going well. Prices are still going up. You're still getting squeezed. Jobs are difficult to find, like you said. Meanwhile, the government is shut down, so a lot of folks are literally not getting paid or not getting any sort of benefits from the government. Meanwhile, we're obviously still paying taxes, right, at a pretty good clip. So, yeah, I'm with you. I don't know why we would have expected some sort of increase in that number. Maybe because it has been close to historic lows, so folks thought maybe we were due for a dead cat bounce, if you will. But like you said, we had a huge move to the downside and almost a record low. Even if you count the great financial crisis, you count early days of COVID, still didn't have a sentiment number quite this low. So I think that's something we'll be keeping an eye on and something that is going to get a little more attention because there's no you know, government stats coming out. So it's how do people feel? And that kind of drive that can drive an economy, that can drive spending going into the holidays, right? If people really feel lousy about their money and their prospects for work, you know, you're probably going to cut your budget for Christmas shopping at the very least. All right. What else do we have going on this week? We do have some Fed speakers. Is that right, Alex? Like a ton of them.
Yeah. There's 11 on the docket. Good deal of voting members. The three I'd keep an eye on. We have Myron speaking on Wednesday. He's the guy who's been the most recent governor appointee. He's been calling for those 50 basis point cuts. He's deep in the Trump camp on that. We have Waller. He's also speaking on Wednesday. I think it's Waller first, then Myron. Different speaking engagements, but you can live stream them, obviously, straight into your home. Myron was the first kind of the old guard governors calling for cuts back in July. And then on the flip side, on Friday, we have Schmid talking. He's the Kansas City governor who was the one calling for a pause at the last meeting. So we should get a really good diversity of opinion this week just from all these different engagements.
Sure. Well, this will be, you know, the week where things kind of settle in after the bit of the minor bomb that was dropped by Powell after the meeting a couple Wednesdays ago, right, where he said we're far from a guaranteed cut in December. But it is starting to feel like we're back to expecting that, right? You have one dissenter, maybe. You have Myron on the other side kind of saying, I think we should cut 50, but 25 will do it, right? It does seem pretty baked in at this point that we'll get that quarter point to end the year in December.
Yep, and that's what the market show right now as well, you know, just expecting a cut.
All right, what else do we have here, gents? Did we cover everything?
I think just about. Hopefully, you know, I wouldn't expect data out as early as next week if we do get a government reopening, but if we do see it reopening, hopefully here in 2 weeks, we should get some good data for late November.
Yeah, yeah, more to come on that. I'm sure there'll be some sort of plan to either restart and probably start from scratch with things like the BLS numbers versus some other numbers. Maybe they would come out in arrears if folks are interested in what, you know, manufacturing looked like in September. But yeah, keep your fingers crossed. Look for the reopening here, hopefully at least partially over this next couple of days. Watch the Fed speakers and keep an eye on I'd say on social media, especially around FHFA. It feels like something has to come out soon that's going to be at least somewhat interesting to our industry. All right, Alex James, as always, a pleasure. Thanks for talking today. Have a good week.
Thank you.
Talking to you.
Welcome, everybody. We're very excited to have Anita Padilla Fitzgerald with us today. Anita is just an amazing person and visionary in our industry. You likely know her. If you don't, hopefully you'll come away today with some really good information about Anita. Too many accomplishments to name on this podcast, but she's the founder of a very successful mortgage company called Megastar, actually here in Denver, where I live. She's also the founder of Take 3 Tech, which includes a platform called Loan Maps, which we'll talk about a little bit later. Loan Maps is a system that helps Megastar and other mortgage companies lower their cost to originate. She's also on several mortgage bank boards and somehow has time for service in the community as well. So welcome. Welcome, Anita. Great to have you here.
I'm happy to be here.
Okay. Where to begin? Maybe just at the beginning of Anita's career. So you started in the mortgage industry as a receptionist, right? So what motivated you from there just to keep climbing that ladder and eventually becoming CEO and founding multiple businesses?
I would say what motivated me was the fact that I started as a receptionist and then I worked every position in the manufacturing chain. So as I worked those positions, I found opportunity, and I've always been competitive. I'm curious about how to make things better. So each time I solve for a problem and try to gain efficiencies, help my manager, the next door open, eventually taking me through every part of loan originations. And that hands-on experience became the foundation for everything I followed. It gave me insight to start businesses, lead teams, and build companies and processes that solve for problems.
That's great. I mean, I think that's a great lesson for young people, right? Just get into any kind of business. I mean, most of us did not go to school or plan to be in mortgage, but we got in, and I mean, you've been in all the areas. A lot of us maybe did one or two. We started maybe post-closing, and then we get into secondary. But you were all around the business learned it, solved problems. That's a huge, I think, lesson for young people when you get out of school, whether it's out of high school or out of college, like be a problem solver, like figure things out rather than wait for things to come to you, right?
Yeah. And when you figure things out, it's really interesting is what I've learned is things really aren't that difficult. And the words that people use, if you take the time to study them, it's really no big deal. And that was very enlightening for me, because then I was able to say, oh, I can do that, or take something that people thought was complicated and make it simple.
Right.
Yeah. And I'll also just give a plug to something you said there about your curiosity. I think that was, you know, when we first met Anita, that was one thing that stood out to me, is that you're always curious in terms of how other folks might be solving problems. And you're very up to speed on the pulse of tech within the industry. That really stood out to me, the depth at which, you know, you were curious about both solutions from OB as well as solutions from folks that we partner with. And I just think that that's a very remarkable quality, and it's a quality that I think a lot of folks should aspire to, is to have that level of curiosity. So another plug there.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I think the love for people also, I just really love people, want to see them be successful, and how can you help them? And when you look at something that's slowing them down, they can't get access to information. So curiosity and really love for people and wanting to see them be successful. That's probably
the wonderful.
That's probably a good segue. So, I mean, you've been running, an extremely strong mortgage company for going on 27 years, I believe, which through the great financial crisis, through COVID, through all of it, and somehow also found time to found Take Three. What is the vision there? So you talked about just people being able to get at data. I know that's a big piece of it, just generally integrating all the different parts of your business and allowing people to work to their strengths. But what is the general vision of Loan Maps and the other tech that you provide?
Yeah. So starting really with the rule tool, when the market crashed and investors, banks, aggregators came out with so many overlays, there was really no consistency. So you had your core, the agency investors, and then all these overlays. I'm very passionate about the self-source loan officer. I look at our business being commoditized, and, you know, hats off to the companies who have done that, Rocket being one of them. They've done a great job building out their tech and bringing information forward to empower human beings and give them information. So the self-source loan officer, I think they bring a huge value to our business, but they need information. So for the rule tool, I said, well, I can just take all the agency guidelines. I can organize that data on the cloud, add the overlays, and then be able to provide the loan officers with the information they need on a Saturday afternoon without standing in line to talk to the underwriters. Underwriters are expensive, right? And our ability to manufacture quality is critical. So we have to provide information. And the rule tool, now integrated with Optimal Blue, it's really powerful. The loan officer's able to see best X based on PPE data, but best X doesn't do you any good if the client doesn't qualify. So to be able to just click a button and get the information in terms of any type of overlays before they lock is critical. In particular, when you're locking a jumbo and the business owners lock best efforts, they have to meet the guideline. You know, it's just really empowering humans. In terms of Loan Maps, same concept. Really, I wanted a report as I grew up in the business and I was asked to manage things. If I couldn't get an accurate report, then it was difficult to manage because we had data in the PPE, we had data in the LOS, you had data here, there. So same concept. I said, well, I can take all of that data and build a system that not is just a front end, but an awesome back end. management of your funded pipeline is critical, right? Final docs, all of those things, if you don't take care of them, that expense can become a burden. So I just took all the data, I call it a source of truth, organized it in a database, and built an end-to-end solution. Reduce the fintech costs so you have one instead of four or five. You have one source of truth where you can provide reports. You can launch AI that will work so you don't have a robot calling a client. I think United Wholesale is doing this where you want to refi, but the broker has the loan in process. Well, they don't know that. But, you know, it's those type of things that go on and on. So as I see these AIs built, I think to myself, you know, they're working off this core that they don't own. And then what happens if the core changes? But, you know, database, data is everything.
Right. So it's that one-stop shop for the originator, as you said, right? Not just self-sourcing clients, but self-sourcing the eligibility, the guidelines, then the resulting data. I want to see my pipeline. I want to report on it. And all that's in one place, including soft guidelines. I think that's one thing you were alluding to, right? When you say Optimal Blue and a pricing engine is going to have those hard guidelines, you know, LTV, FICO, but you're able to overlay other soft guidelines that get deeper into the credit report or deeper into the collateral. That's fantastic. It just, like you said, it streamlines it to where the loan officer is not spending time and others in operations are not spending time talking to them. Yeah. I mean, that kind of verbal discussion is kind of an old school concept at this point, especially at Megastar.
Yeah. And non-QM makes it even more complicated, right? I mean, sure. It's just a lot of information in our world and aggregating that into digestible content where people can apply human intelligence, make great decisions, and lower cost to produce.
Right.
Yeah. And one of the things that I was most excited about with the Roll Tool when we first started talking about integration opportunities was Ask Augie, the AI powered, you know, question and answer capability within the Roll Tool. Cause I just think that's a great use of AI to ask a question, a specific question, and have, you know, the AI tool read the, you know, the structured data from the Roll Tool and provide that specific response back. So you don't need to go looking through tools, or, you know, you might even, you know, with keyword search, which is, you know, still powerful, you still might have multiple matches and you got to figure out exactly which one is going to be most relevant for you. But Ask Augie, I thought, was really cool because it's just, you know, ask your question, get your response. And I think also shows, you know, the prowess that Take Three has and Megastar has with AI. And so maybe just to segue on that a little bit, I'll also mention that, you know, there's, you know, probably everyone's sick about hearing about AI in our industry, or a lot of folks, you know, it's AI everything. But I have to say the amount of folks that I have met who are really in the weeds about AI, what it's good at, what are some of the challenges with AI, I think still fairly small percentage of folks in our industry. Still a lot of people who are, you know, in the process of getting up to speed. But Anita, I think, you know, you and your team have really been at the forefront of understanding AI, where it's applicable, what it can do, and then just going after those opportunities. And I'm curious just where you see things heading in the next, let's say, you know, 5 or 10 years as it relates to AI.
Yeah. Well, AI is a buzzword. And where I think our industry is today, I think about the dot-com phase, right? Anything with a dot-com and all this equity venture, I mean, just crazy money coming at this stuff. The reality is AI is really not new. It's just a matter of grabbing data and then, you know, applying, you know, querying your data, applying some logic, and then having the system produce a result. So it keeps going back to that core. If you don't have, I call it a skeleton, right? Which is, you know, the skeleton of the body is that data. And without one master data warehouse, one source of truth, I don't see how all of these AIs are going to stand the test of time. And then owners, unfortunately, aren't going to get the results they need, losing trust. I mean, trust in our industry is critical. The loan officers need to trust it. So I built loan maps for the industry. And sure, I owned a mortgage company. And I thought to myself, people keep telling me that we're rare and that we have been profitable every month, every year since my company opened. So I think the industry's been good to me, and I want to give back. And I'm very passionate about the self-sourced loan officers and the owners who serve them. So I built loan maps for the industry to help them. So in terms of the AI industry, Kevin, I don't know. I would be afraid. I wouldn't build a company off of a core system that I didn't manage. I just wouldn't. But, you know, some pretty smart people out there, and I don't claim to know everything. I'm a common sense person, always have been.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I definitely see that challenge out there when we're thinking about AI. Whose data, you know, are we working with? Does it paint a complete picture of what's happening out there? And then also, there's naturally things that I think AI is better at or better, better positioned to solve problems. And then there are things that AI still can't do. You still can't tell it to, hey, you know, build me an LOS, and then it just goes and does that. That's not a real problem that AI can solve for you. But both Megastar, Take Three, and Optimal Blue have done a lot of work to identify where those opportunities are. Ask Augie being one great example, and also our Originator Assistant, which is similarly applying AI to go look at rules, guideline, and pricing rules within a lender's PPE account to be able to produce suggestions for small changes in a loan scenario. So, you know, that's that core, you know, if you will, that we have, that we can leverage AI to provide, you know, solve problems and provide a benefit back to lenders. And so I think that's very in line kind of with how we're approaching things with what you're talking about with Megastar and Take Three.
You're absolutely right, Kevin. AI absolutely has its place. I mean, we have AI all throughout loan maps, all throughout the rule tool. And the goal really is to help people be smarter, faster, make good decisions, right? Ronald Reagan always said, trust but verify. Well, you know, that's true. And you have to trust the technology that's working for you, because if it's just taking off on its own, and the loan officer or, you know, the relationship manager, I mean, that's a big deal, right? They want to be able to trust it. But you also, as an owner, you have to lower your cost, and you have to produce quality, and you have to have a loan that you can deliver into the secondary market. I mean, that is all mission critical. But I agree with you. And like with Augie, in the rule tool, you can just ask them a question. Or to your point, the keyword search is powerful because it's a great trainer. Bring in a new person. Speaking of training, Loan Maps, Augie in Loan Maps will read your MSMO file and say, hey, by the way, before you run your AUS, you're missing these fields. It'll coach the consumer who's applying, well, I need this data for a prequal, but if you want an upfront approval, I need this data. Then it helps the loan officer walk all the way documentation. Let's talk about day one certainty and aim. So the validations are only with Fannie Freddie, but everybody's like, you know, click, 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 digital, digital, digital. Well, let's stop, because first of all, it doesn't work for FHA, VA, USDA, and jumbo. And it only works in some cases for Fannie Freddie. So Augie will actually recommend a documentation path to the loan officer. Hey, this is a good, this person could actually achieve D1C or AIM, but do you want to pay for the work number, because you're never going to get D1C or AIM because they don't meet the minimum qualification. But they're telling you, they're telling the owners just click, 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 click. And every time they click, it costs them money. So Augie's in there doing that and even telling if, like, I don't know how to order a credit report. Well, just ask him and he'll tell you step by step in terms of using the technology.
Right. So, I mean, at the end of the day, today, AI is still very young, but there are a lot of practical, you kind of have to start with practical applications. Where can I really use this? And you have to start with a very tight, accurate data structure, right? To your point, Anita, with loan maps, we've certainly done that in OB with things like the originator assistant, the P&L assistants. When we know the data is accurate and tight, like our eligibility guidelines, it works very well. But down the road, you know, I think it'll become a bit more imaginable. But if you go, if you get ahead of your skis, you're going to run into issues where the AI gathers data that you either don't manage or that you can't rely on. And then you're going to get bad answers. And then the feedback loop becomes much less efficient.
Yep. Yep. So, you know, and back to digital validation, until the market, all the agencies accept it, right? And the rating agencies are comfortable with the result and the performance of the loan that was based on a digital verification plus validation, the industry's not there yet. So I took that in mind when I built loan maps. I thought, okay, these business owners need to make sure they are able to deliver the loan. So I started out with, I'm going to partner very tightly with the agencies because they're the keepers of the gold. So we're the first organization that has the income calculator results back from the self-employed income calculator. So you can actually get a day one certainty on self-employed. But my point is, it doesn't cost the owner money. So when I sit and I look at some of these companies paying $75 to run an income calc, I think to myself, well, you're just taking data and moving it into an income calculator. The human being still has to go in and make sure that all the lines are appropriate. If they're not, they're not going to honor the aim or the day one certainty. So we work very closely with the agencies, keep costs down, show the loan officer the documentation path, use the income calculator, and you literally have a upfront approval and if you have the documentation that's required for self-employed and many wage people, bonus, commission, whatnot, immediately. And it's literally a certificate to deliver the loan into the secondary market. And you don't have to pay $75 or $200 because it's part of the system. So yeah, I think the market still has a way to go with all the other agencies in the span of clients that can actually qualify. And then lenders don't use, a lot of lenders that I've talked to about their manufacturing cycle, they don't use day one certainty or AIM. One person told me that their underwriters told them that it didn't work or something like that. And it's the CEO of a company. And I was just like, okay. Yeah. Or the CU scores. I mean,
doing it.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. We've talked quite a bit about tech. We've talked about some of the opportunity that exists. Another topic that's near and dear to us at OB and in our industry in general, you know, our industry has many strong women like yourself, Anita, but I think we would certainly be pegged behind other industries, not just in, you know, the number of women, but, you know, the folks in leadership and product roles. And you know, what advice would you provide for women looking to break into fintech, mortgage, financial services to help them, you know, reach that level of leadership? And what can the industry do to support women who are looking to go down that role?
You know, I could give you the standard answers of the first one who has to believe in yourself is you, right? But what I have found in my career, and you know, I've had that question not only as a woman, but also a woman of color. Has that been an issue for you? You know, my answer is really no. And because I think I have been curious and I brought value to my employers, they would give me opportunities. Now, as an executive woman, I will tell you that, you know, men have their groups, whether they're golfing or smoking cigars or whatever it is men do. But, you know, that's just our world. And, you know, shame on us women for not having those same groups so that we can be collaborating and learning and sharing. I'm actually starting a group. I'm going to call it CANI, Constant and Never-Ending Improvement for Executive Women. I'm inviting some women to my home in Park City so we can get together and just collaborate. So, you know, women need to support women. And I will tell you that in my community in Denver, I have met other Latina women that are very, very successful entrepreneurs, federal judges appointed by the President of the United States. And we have really worked to help each other connect. And so, you know, for women, I say, you know, be strong, be curious, and believe in yourself. And if you're working for a company that doesn't recognize the value you bring, then maybe you need to find another company. But, you know, women are nurturers. We're organizers. We're hard workers. And, you know, women just tend to really care about that human being. Not that men don't, but, you know, we're mothers. We're mothers. And we're abuelos.
Man, that's a great, powerful message, Anita. Thank you. You articulated that really well. And I think you had some interesting an interesting take on this, and excited to see how this new group shapes up. I think that's a very proactive approach to take to trying to just cultivate, you know, more powerful women in our industry and throughout, you know, just the working world. So really appreciate that you're doing that and for sharing that with us. And that's probably a good note to end on. I think that's, I don't know what kind of question we could ask that would top that. Anita, thank you so much. This has been amazing interview. Thank you for taking time today. I know you're spending some time with your family this week, and that's super important as well. So thanks for having a little discussion with us this morning, and we hope to talk again real soon.
Right on. Well, Kevin and Jim, thank you guys very much.
All awesome. Right. Thanks, Anita.
Thanks again, Anita. Take care.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
Okay, let's wrap this thing up. Huge thanks to Alex and James. Great discussion. And of course, Anita, what a great interview. Thanks again for being on the podcast today. And that's it. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning into Optimal Insights.
Speed matters in lending, and borrowers expect instant answers. But traditional loan locking ties you to a desk, slowing decisions and creating friction. That's why Optimal Blue introduced mobile locking in our mobile app. Now, loan officers can lock loans anytime, anywhere, fast, secure, and accurate. Access your live pipeline, update loan details, run pricing, and complete locks right from your phone. No delays, no desk dependency. Just instant action that enhances the borrower experience. Unlike browser-based tools, mobile locking is built into our native iOS and Android app for faster load times, stronger security, and a seamless experience. And the best part? It's included at no extra cost for all Optimal Blue PPE users. Download the Optimal Blue mobile app today and start locking loans on the go. Access, price, lock, it's that simple.